anxiety's ended, my doubt's ended. I don't know what those words mean anymore. I don't know what they've meant for the last eight and a half years. When you live in faith, you can't live in fear. When you live in a total surrender, and this is what it has done for me. And I'm just going to cite some of the things that are going on in my life. I just talked about my car, okay? I have a daughter. I have two wonderful, loving daughters. And one of them has blessed me with a grandchild. She was in a relationship with a guy who I absolutely would pick the opposite of if I had to choose. But then I remember things in the book that say, you know, Shakespeare said all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players. What he forgot to mention is that I was the chief critic. That I knew everything that was best for you and you and you in God's handiwork. So I have come to the point where I accept that everybody is exactly who they are and where they are supposed to be today. And I've accepted my daughter's choices in her relationship, as destructive as it may be. And right now, the last I saw my daughter was last Monday night. We all watched the Laker game together. Now, the father of my grandson is not capable of working for a living. It's not anything physical or mental. He just doesn't feel that he should work. He feels that other people should support him. And even though my daughter has, like, cursed him up and down, I treat him as I would treat a sick person, the way the big book says, and recognize the fact that I have no idea what motivates him or drives him or causes him the pain to behave the way he behaves. Well, what happened was he was the third in a long line of guys that my daughter just took off the street and supported, who never worked, and who abused her emotionally and even physically. And all I could do was love her for the whole thing and try to understand where she's coming from. And because of my experience, it says in the promises, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will realize that our experience can benefit others. And I have looked into my daughter's eyes many a time. My daughter's addicted to drugs right now and to destructive relationships. And I've looked in her eyes and she said, "Dad, I'm doing the best I can." And I've seen me 10 years ago when doctors, family, loved ones, friends said, "Richie, you're killing yourself. What are you doing? Stop." I said, "I can't. I want to. I'm doing the best I can." And I was doing the best I can. So that compassion that people had for me and showed to me, I can have and show for my daughter. I recognize it. And one of the biggest gifts I had recently was at a retreat I did a few weeks ago. I shared a lot. You know, a retreat, I have more time. I shared a lot about my daughter and what I went through with her and the things she's going through. And a couple of people said, "You know what we got out of that stuff you shared with your daughter? That no matter how bizarre the situation, how crazy it seems, you really love that kid." And that's the gift. That's the gift that this program has given me. I not only love her, I love her destructive relationship people that she's in, because it's God's business what happens. And what I've gone through with my daughter, and this is part of steps 2 and 3, you know, to make that complete surrender, to know that there's a plan for everything, is when she was pregnant, her boyfriend wasn't there. He had disappeared. He kept coming back like a cold sore, I call it, you know. And I can't say like a thorn, you know. And he disappeared. So I was able and willing to take my daughter to her doctor's appointment. And we'd go every week, and, you know, because of my films and stuff that are constantly shown on TV, people recognize me, my voice and that, and he said, "Weren't you really fat?" And I go, "Yes, really fat, you know." And we talked about it. So he used to say every meeting, every visit with my daughter, he would say, "Why don't you eat like your dad? He knows how to eat, you know." And that would always embarrass me. But he would tell her what to eat. He would tell her that she's going to have toxemia, that there's going to be complications with her and the baby, and she must stay away from sodium, and she must stay away from this. And then we would go out to lunch, and she would order a corned beef sandwich with pickles and potatoes. And I go, "Stace, didn't the doctor just tell you about this?" She says, "Oh, Dad, I'm doing the best I can." She says, "I only eat, you know, after the doctor's visit. It's the only time I eat this stuff." And then it clicked in, how many times did I go to diet doctors, you know, and after I lost 4 pounds, celebrate. You know what I mean? So she was celebrating because she gained 12. You know, I don't know where the mentality came from, but it was the same behavior. You know, that same kind of behavior. And being there, I could recognize it, and I could say to her, "Honey, just try to do a little bit better." And then she would light up a cigarette. And I sat with that girl and watched the commercial where they show a pregnant woman smoking, and they show the fetus, the baby with a cigarette dangling out of their mouth, you know. And that's kind of scary to me, and I wasn't even pregnant. And I said, "You see that?" She says, "Dad, I'm doing the best I can," you know. So I knew that. And we went to the doctor the next time, and I asked her, "Where was her urine specimen?" And she said, "Oh, I forgot. It's no big deal." And I knew the same from my experience. She forgot conveniently because she knew she didn't want to hear what was in there. Well, the doctor said, "I won't buy that." He said, "I want you to give me one now." And he took a specimen, and he didn't like what he saw. And he said, "I can't let you go home. I'm sending you down to the lab to take a blood test and that, because there's something in there that really scares me." Well, I sat in that waiting room, and I said the Serenity Prayer 34 times. I counted. The 34th time, it dawned on me, you know, to change, you know, that God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. I cannot change my daughter. To change the things I can is my attitude. My attitude was, I recognized that once more I was living in fear. Where was my faith? Where's my faith that God had a plan for this? So I went home, and the next morning I prayed about it. I get on my knees every day. I'll talk about that sometime today. For a guy that came from totally agnostic to totally, you know, I'll do anything to get a conscious contact with God 24 hours a day, every minute of the day. I got to figure out how many minutes. Does anyone know how many minutes are in a day? That's how much I want to be in contact with God. So I got on my knees and I said, "God, I want to, you know, give this to you. It's just tough for me. It's upsetting, it's et cetera." And God said, "Richie, I got her and I got the baby." And I visualized this beautiful palm, God's hand. And in there was sitting Stacy and her little baby. And his other hand was going, "Choo, choo, get away, get away, I got it, get away." You know, and what was revealed to me that day, God said, "Richie, this has nothing to do with you. If Stacy is going to die, if the baby is going to die, it's her hard lesson that she's going to have to learn and that you're going to have to accept there's a reason for it all. So just trust me that I know better than you why all this is going on." And from that day, I let it go. Now, naturally, the baby was like 9 pounds, 15 ounces. He's a linebacker already, you know. She was fine, you know. She didn't die or anything like that. She continued smoking. And then I had this wonderful conversation with her about how healthy it was, because we watched programs and read books about how healthy it was for her to nurse the baby, not only physically but emotionally for the mother and the child. And she was nursing the baby, and we had this wonderful conversation, and I was so proud of her, you know, for doing that. And the next day she called me and told me she wasn't nursing anymore. And I said, "How come?" And she said, "Well, because I'm still smoking, and I'm still smoking grass, and I found out that it could make the baby toxic, colic, and I don't want to hurt the baby." So it was like a double-edged sword, like it says in the book. You know, on one hand, I wish she would nurse the baby, but on the other hand, at least she was aware enough that she didn't want to harm the baby. And till this day, even though my other daughter and I have sent welfare people up to the house anonymously because we're afraid that the baby wasn't really being taken care of properly, and then turned that over, I believe that my daughter is a loving, good mother. She smokes grass and blows it in the baby's face. and she does other things that could be harmful to the baby, but that's none of my business. You know, my business is, I know that she's the last person in the world that wants to hurt that baby, but she can't help herself. So when it gets too out of hand, I try to make sure that the right help is there. So all this stuff is simply God. I mean, like, I got to tell you the story. Last year during the Laker playoffs, the baby was a few months old, and I'm a big Laker fan, and so are my kids. In fact, I took my grandson to the victory parade, and he had a Laker jacket and a sweatshirt, and he was like 3 months old. And everybody freaked out, you know, that this kid was at the Laker. But that, you know, in his future, he'll know that he was, you know, there when they were world champs. And so we went over the house, and this was, he was about 3 months old. And I went with my daughter, Gwen, my youngest daughter, and my nephew, who was visiting from New York. And there was Stacy and her boyfriend and two of his friends. And they were all doing cocaine and stuff, you know, which, again, is none of my business. I just say no thank you. And they also sell it, you know. And she had two dogs, and one of them was a pit bull who snapped at everything and everyone, ate every piece of furniture in the house, and that was another thing I had to turn over to God. So we were watching the game. It was against the Celtics, and the Lakers won on, like, a miracle shot in the last minute. And I was holding the baby, and I jumped up, and everyone was screaming, and the two dogs went at each other. And they turned over the table, and when they turned over the table, the cocaine spilled. And everyone started getting crazy. And one of the guys was on a crutch, and he tried to separate the dogs with a crutch, and the pit bull jumped at him. And I took the baby into the bedroom and closed the door, and everyone was screaming and fighting and going crazy. And when it all calmed down, I came out, and they were still pissed about the wasted drugs, more than anything else, and I could relate to that, you know. And I came out, and I said to Gwen and my nephew, "You ready to go?" They said, "Yeah." And I kissed my daughter and I kissed the baby. One thing I did while I was there was when they were smoking grass and all that stuff, I said to the baby, I said, "Tell your mother that when everybody's getting stoned in the room so that you don't get a contact high, that maybe she should put you in the bedroom." And my daughter said, "Dad, give me a fucking break, will you?" I said, "I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the baby." You know what I mean? So it's like I get my messages across, you know, sometimes, once in a while, no matter what. So anyway, we gave the baby back, and we left. And we got in the car, and my nephew, who was just visiting, looked, he said, "I don't believe that." So what? I said, "What just went on there?" He said, "And you're, like, really calm." He said, "I mean, like, you are really calm. I mean, like, that didn't affect you, did it?" And I go, "No, it didn't affect me because God's in charge of the whole thing." He says, "Oh, I forgot." You know, and he calls me Billy Graham sometimes. You know. He said, "I forgot, Billy," you know, and this and that. I go, "No, but that's the truth." I said, "Do I have any control?" And the truth of it was, during that period of time, my youngest daughter said to her sister, she said, "Stacy, look at the baby. What are you doing?" She goes, "Gwen, it's my fucking kid, and I'll do what I want." You know, and that was, I said to her, I said, "You heard what Stacy said. It's her kid. She'll do what she wants. You know, it's not my kid, and it's really God's kid." See, and what I'm trying to relate to you here is my complete surrender is what gives me that. My complete surrender. As soon as I think I could do something about it, I see that little hand of God. Now it's like with the baby in it too. It's like two people in the palm now, you know. And he's going, "I got it. I got it," you know. And somehow, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. And what I get to do is that when I'm there, I get to take the baby in a loving, healthy environment, which is me. I get to see my daughter, get my daughter to see what a loving, healthy environment is, which is me. My daughter's birthday is Monday. I'll be back and we're all going to go to dinner, you know, the baby and my daughter and my other daughter. And she says, "Well, what about let's do something Sunday night?" I go, "No, I'm going to be in Palm Springs." She says, "For what?" I said, "Oh, hey, I'm doing a marathon." She went, "You really got the life." And I go, "You really know that, don't you?" You know. So both my daughters, my other daughters are compulsive overeaters. Stacy's compulsive overeater, addict, alcoholic, whatever you want to say. But I love them both to death, and they both know what this program has done for me. Many times they've complained that I'm selfish because I give more to OA than I give to them. That's not true. I give exactly what I need to give, and I have a balance in my life. There's not a day that I don't give to my family, and sometimes the best way I can give is to stay away from them, you know. And what I tell Stacy whenever we have a difference of opinion, I said, Stacy, you're not right or wrong, I'm not right or wrong. You're not good or bad, I'm not good or bad. But aren't we different? You know, we think differently. We live differently. So let's try to overcome that and look at each other as people who love each other but have a different opinion on a lot of things and try to overcome that. I said, do you believe I love you? She said, absolutely. I said, that's all that ever matters. And I just sent her a card for her birthday. And I don't get one of these fancy cards about her being the daughter that I always wanted to have and at the prom and all that kind of stuff because I don't live that way. I got her a card that says you're dazzling, energetic, beautiful, talented. It's no wonder you take after your father. You know, something to that effect. And then I just wrote her a little note. I hope this is the best year of your life and I just want you to know that I love you and want the best for you. And that's all I ever have to tell her, you know. And she knows that. And God is in charge of all the rest. Now, I'd like to share a little bit how I got to that point. I was abstaining no matter what. That was my first step, you know. The book said that we need to get the fog out of our brain so that we can go on to bigger and better things. You abstain and the rest will follow. So I used to get up and say things like, well, I lost 150 pounds. I don't know about this God shit, but something here works, you know. And that was my pitch, you know, how much weight I lost, what I was eating, what my food plan was, etc. And everyone said that was great, you know. And then it started to dawn on me that all the people who, quote-unquote, had what I wanted were talking about spiritual things and the G word, you know, and that HP stuff, you know. And it was the people who would get up there and go, well, I've been maintaining a 100-pound weight loss now. It says, my house burnt down and someone stole my cat and dogs and my kid took my car and disappeared. But I don't have to eat over it. You know, and life is great. And I went, give me a break. You know, I mean, and one of the first speakers I heard at a marathon was this guy who talked about losing his house and his Mercedes, and his wife left him, and took his clothes and threw them in the trash, it was the best thing that ever happened to him. And I said, give me a break. You know, so about a year later, there was a guy pitching at a meeting how he lost his house, that he had a tax lien on it, that he had no car, that all his material things were gone, he wasn't working, and he's never been happier. And it was me. And it was truth. It happened to me about 3 years into the program. I had to get rid of my house and pay off taxes. My car was, I had a choice, either to buy, I had leased a car and it was the end of the 4-year lease. I either could buy it or turn it in, and I couldn't afford to buy it, so I turned it in. And that next year was the best year of my life. I was taking the RTD. I started writing dialogues to God. I started being so grateful and recognizing what truly the gifts of life were. And here it was, all those people who spoke of these spiritual things, it was all true. And it was all happening in my life far before I saw it. And it says in the book that we will recognize in others sooner than in ourselves. And I spoke at a marathon in the San Fernando Valley, and I thought I pitched the same thing as I usually pitch. And 4 or 5 people said, you know, I'd like to call you up and talk about your conception of higher power and God and stuff. I go, no, I think you meant the speaker before me. They said, no, you, I love where you're at with your surrender and your peace of mind. I go, you do? I got that? Yeah? They said, yeah, you know. I go, wow, that's great. You know, where did that come from? And then I remembered what really helped me a lot was my willingness to go to a lot of meetings, to go to big book study and step study meetings. And in step 2, there's a paragraph again, here's a book that was written 40, 50 years ago that relates my exact experience. And in step two, it says we need to quit arguing which came first, the chicken or the egg. And that, let me just think what it says now, what I want to say. It says, I don't know when or how I came to believe in a power greater than myself, but somehow it infiltrated my life. All I had to do was quit arguing and work the remaining steps to the best of my ability. So I quit arguing about the God stuff. I quit trying to figure it out, and I was just willing to work the steps to the best of my ability, and it infiltrated my life. And the best description I ever heard, which was my experience, was like when I finished with step 9, which the big book says then you will get the promises of the program, like God came in and said, hi, Richie, I'm God, how you doing? I go, oh, great, nice to meet you. And I had my spiritual awakening. You know, it was the process. I suddenly realized that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And it just happened because I was willing to do the things that you suggested I do. Now, what happened with the third step was also I went to a step study meeting. And the big question that I always heard was the big answer, what is God's will and what is my will, you know? And over the years, I've heard simplistic things like a good friend of mine who I'm so happy we're going to do a men's retreat together, Peter. Peter said, if you ever stuck on what God's will is and what your will is, ask yourself, what would a loving person do? And then you know you're doing God's will. So that's how simple it can get. But in the 12 and 12, in step 3, it says it's not the quantity of faith, but the quality of faith that counts. That never had we cleaned house and asked God to lift the obsession. Never had we been willing to give of ourselves without asking something and, you know, demanding something in return, and so on and so forth. And it just describes in a capsule the steps. And then at the bottom it says, so what is God's will? What we need to do is conform our will with God's will. It says this right in step 3. It says, how do we do this? It says, the way that we do it is to work the remaining steps to the best of our ability. To show God that we're willing to turn our will and our life over to Him. For me, what it had to be was to get all the things out of the way that were blocking my ability to get God in my life, which was food and drugs and substances and resentments and anger and judgments and criticizing and controlling and all the things that blocked me from doing God's will. So how do I get to do that? Is by doing the rest of the steps. And what happened was, now I know what God's will is for me. God's will is for me not to live by the 7 deadly sins, but by the spiritual actions that are the opposite of those 7 deadly sins. And that's the stuff that I'll get into later this afternoon. I don't want to jump ahead of myself. But my experience with the first 3 steps is simply the first step was to stop giving food the power by abstaining. It's that simple. Someone said, you want to admit you're powerless over it? Stop eating. You want to find out why you're eating? Stop eating first. You know, when I came in here, I really thought that you would throw me out if I didn't abstain. I wish that everybody that walked into these rooms had that same attitude today, because that's what it took for me. That if I want to live, I have to abstain. If I want to die, I could keep eating. And a lot of times, and I'll just take a few more minutes to tell you about my experience with abstinence. My first 6 months, I told you how rigid I was. Not only did I eat 8, noon, and 6, but I wouldn't waver one iota from my food plan, because I believed that if I wasn't losing weight or maintaining weight, I wasn't abstinent. My opinion of that has changed over the years. But I could tell you that the food that I ate, and I'll tell you exactly what some people may be interested. I'm not a nutritionalist, but I could tell you that from what I eat, I've learned over the years, I eat from the 4 basic food groups. I eat balanced nutritional food, and I don't need a lot of food to nourish my body and fuel it. I'm a very active human being. I don't need vitamins. I don't need any extra protein or extra starch if I'm going to go on a walkathon or anything like that. All I need to eat is what I usually eat is shredded wheat or grape nuts in the morning because they have no salt, sugar in them, with fresh fruit and skim milk. That's what I eat, you know, most of the time. Or non-fat yogurt with fruit, you know. And it's great. Angie Dickinson taught me, I used to eat, you know, fruit yogurt. She said, there's too much garbage in that. She said, get non-fat yogurt, take it sweet and low, slice in your favorite fruit, mix it up, and it's delicious. And that's how I've been eating it ever since. You know, I did a show with her about 9 years ago. So that's what I eat in the morning. For lunch, you know, give me salad. Give me, you know. I used to sponsor someone who used to call his food into me. He used to have two heads of lettuce and a cabbage, you know, and a tomato. And he goes, I need bulk. I need crunch. You know, I go, whatever works for you, you know, go for it. And, you know, and eventually, you know, I heard people start their absence with 3 banquets a day and nothing in between. And, you know, all I could tell you is I've been abstaining now for 8 years and 10 months. My first 6 months was rigid. About a year ago Thanksgiving, I had hit bottom again with my sloppiness with my food. So I made a decision to go on a very rigid abstinence for 60 days. And I did it for 60 days. Periodically over the years, I've done that. When I get sick and tired, and it's only a lack of discipline. My problem has been over the years, I am not obsessed with food anymore, but I have a defect of character called gluttony, which every once in a while says, Richie, you deserve to have something, you know, better than what you've been eating. And I'll go out and rationalize that a quarter pound of yogurt-covered almonds is the same as an orange, you know. And not admit, you know, not admit that just because I'm comfortably nude watching a basketball game, and just because I get all dressed and drive to the market to weigh out a quarter pound of yogurt doesn't mean I'm obsessed with them. You know what I mean? It's just like, you know, rationalizing. So what happens is I go through periods of life like that, and I get a rebate in my weight. You know, or something starts feeling a little tight. So I don't know. I pray. I do everything. I don't know what gives me the willingness sometimes to be as rigid as I need to be. But it comes when it comes. I can only share my experience. I'm not advocating this. I could tell you that in my experience in 8.5 years or more of abstinence now, I have had my fluctuations in weight. I have had my weeks or months of imperfect abstinence, but I refuse to beat myself over it. I need to be easy on myself. I am still in the area of maintaining a 200-pound weight loss for almost 9 years, so obviously that kind of mentality works for me. If it doesn't work for you, that's okay. Be rigid, it's okay. But I need to lighten up on myself and recognize the fact that part of my disease is up here with those rationalizations, you know, and that I'll never be perfect. And that was another part of my disease, was my perfectionism, my need to be perfect. And I don't need to be that anymore. But I know, you know what the definition of my abstinence is today? Each and every day I ask God to please give me the strength to practice discipline rather than gluttony. And for him to know that I'm doing the very, very best I can with food. And sometimes I don't do it perfectly, but I aim to do the very best I can. And in step 6, which without skipping ahead, it says, what's step 6 say? We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Says in step 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. It's OA's way of stating the best possible attitude one can take in a lifetime job. That our character defects may not be eliminated overnight the way our obsession for food was, but we need to aim towards the very best we know or can learn. And that's what I do every day with my abstinence. I aim towards the very best I know or can learn. And sometimes I fall a little short, but I know that I'm doing the very best I can. And at night, God says, you did the best you can. Let's try to do a little better tomorrow. by practicing a little better discipline. Maybe let's call somebody. Maybe let's do something else. Maybe let's do what I do. I carry around a pamphlet before you take that first compulsive bite. And if I take the time to read that before each meal, I don't compulsively overeat. If I take the time to ask God each morning to give me the strength and the discipline, I don't overeat. If I take the time before each meal to pray, if I'm by myself or with another person, very rarely do I overeat. If I take the time before I go to the supermarket to ask God to stop me from grazing in the bins, I don't graze in the bins. It's that simple. But if I get back to forgetting what does it for me, then I have that ability to be a glutton. And my favorite glutton story, which many of you have heard, which I guess I'm supposed to tell because I thought of it, is after the maintainers meeting in L.A., and the maintainers meeting I always describe as if you don't have to read Cosmopolitan or Vogue or any of those magazines to know it's in style. You just go where the hip, slick, and cool people are at the maintainers meeting in L.A., and they will show you, okay? So after the maintainers meeting, they go to fellowship at a place called Hamburger Henry's, which is, a compulsive overeater's delight, which is a salad bar, all you can eat as many times as you want to go up. So most of the time, my barometer in those places is one trip no matter what. Now, another good thing I've learned in OA over the years is how to build a salad bar with big pieces outside so everything falls in, you know. To the point where I go to a place, everyone should try, called the Sea Lion in Malibu. Beautiful place to go for dinner. They have a great salad bar. Great salad bar. I was going through there, and there were a bunch of normies behind me, and they said, and they were talking, and listen, they go, we have to tell you, we were talking, that is one of the most beautiful salads we've ever seen, you know, in our life. And I said, trust me, it's years of experience, guys. I said, believe me, I know what I'm doing, you know. And they go, and it's so clean, you don't put in any of that marinated stuff. I go, no, trust me, years of experience, okay? So that was my thing in Hamburger Henry's, that I would go for one trip only. So I built my condominium on the plate, and I got back and I ate it. Now, I know, like I've shared a lot this morning, that it doesn't take much food to fuel my body. Anything beyond that is my own bullshit, you know. Anything beyond three moderate meals is my own bullshit, saying, well, I did an hour and a half advanced class. That's all bullshit. I know that, you know. So anyway, I finished this, and now my head says, Richie, you really look great. I think you look a little thin. I think, in fact, like you look almost like Schwarzenegger, but too thin. And like, I think you should go back and get some fruit. Did you have fruit this morning? Did you have a full cup of fruit? Now, that's, you know, gluttony speaking. That's the disease. So now, in the past, it was no contest, I'd be back. But just as I'm getting up, you know, God steps in. Because every day, I seek the consciousness of God. And God says, whoa, wait a minute. He said, what about the discipline that we talked about? What about, like, one plate no matter what? He said, now, here's your choice. See, I never had a choice before. He says, here's the choice. On this side is Richie's way. 400 pounds, you know, whacked out of your bird, miserable, self-pity, remorse, loathing yourself. On this side is happy, joyous, free, foxy, you know, the freedom, feeling good about yourself, self-esteem. He says, well, you got a choice. So now what happens is one of those little things like I talked about, you're not going to faint between meals. One of my dear friends in L.A. once shared that he never had a problem eating between meals. His problem was when the meal was over, when to stop. So if he wasn't sure when lunch was over, he would just say out loud, lunch is over, and it's over, you know, finished. So here I was battling gluttony, discipline, and all of a sudden somebody said, out of my mouth, lunch is over. And the waiter said, pardon me? I said, check, please, you know, and that was it. So now that happens to me about 90-95% of the time, because I'm always seeking the God consciousness. But 5% of the time, or sometimes 10%, I go, fuck it. I'm going back and have the fruit. And then I do deal with the remorse and self-pity and why did I do it kind of thing. So what I could tell you is over the years it happens fewer times in between because more and more I love the feeling of practicing the discipline. And that, to me, is being loyal to God. See, if I'm practicing a spiritual principle, I'm doing God's will. If I'm practicing gluttony, I'm doing my own will. So I have to define the difference between them, and I'll tell you later how I do that.